Hey, welcome to the show. You are listening to the Rusik Podcast. We are a roots music podcast based out of Nashville, Tennessee, where we talk to the local music scene and beyond.
Today we have Robbie Music. He is a guitar player, songwriter. He plays around town here in Nashville.
If you are listening to this episode on Spotify or any other platform where you listen to your podcast, you're going to want to head on over to our YouTube channel at Rusik Podcast. Over there, you can look at performance videos from all of our guests. You can also watch the podcast that you're listening to right now. Go subscribe over there. It helps us out a ton. Check it out.
Yeah.
I will hear no PBR slander on this podcast.
We drank so much PBR in college that
at least it wasn't natural light.
Natty light.
And then
I never stooped that low.
Well, then natty light and then natural ice came out, which is like
even worse.
They cut
natty light in half with more water.
Yeah. Isn't the ice just mean they put a little more alcohol in it?
That's what they say, but it doesn't taste like that.
Yeah.
Huh.
Because Bud Ice came out and same thing, it just tasted shittier.
Yeah, no, they're worse for sure.
Yeah, we drank some PBRs in our day, Brian, but you know what, look at us now,
but here we are drinking Topo Chicos and talking about the good old days.
Adults.
Drinking bubbly water like fucking men, you know.
When I was a kid, we weren't wealthy enough to ever go to a restaurant where they ask you flat or sparkling. You know,
I don't even know as a grown ass man if I've ever been.
Oh, really?
Been
if you go to a semi nice restaurant,
yeah.
They always give you the option. Would you like flat or sparkling?
Very nice.
And I think back to it, and as a kid, if someone would have said, "Do you want water that is bubbly but it doesn't have the sugar and flavor of soda?" I would have said, "No, get away from me! soda will do just fine." You know. No soda water.
Wait, are you from around here originally?
No, I'm from Cleveland, Ohio.
Oh, nice. Okay. When did you come out to Nashville?
2010, January the 20th, 2010.
Okay.
I remember the day that specifically because not only was it like a life changer for like what I'd always wanted to do, but I was in a band and a buddy of mine called me. He had moved down a year prior to me. And he said, "We need a guitar player tomorrow." And I was like, "Oh man, I don't think I can make that happen."
Yeah.
And he goes, "All right, well, we're going to get a fill in, but I want you to come down and do an audition." And it just so happened that the band that I was in was going to Memphis because they have an international blues challenge every year. And it's like bands from all over the world. Mm-hmm. And, you know, when they say the best of the best, it's fine. Like some of them are great. Some of them are not. But yeah. You compete anyway. So like we were going down to compete and we ended up taking third place in that competition.
Oh, wow.
But on the way to Memphis, I stopped in Nashville and I did... it's always air quotes. Like I did an audition. Mm-hmm. It was more of like a, "Hey, if you're cool, you got the gig."
Yeah.
Like, yeah. If you know the songs and you know, whatever, like we're not really going to like, yeah, we just want to make sure that mm-hmm. you're not a dick. So I did the audition. I got the gig. They told me I got the gig and then I had to go to Memphis and like pretend like my band was, you know, still
yeah.
a viable option. None of them knew except for the keyboard player because he was with me actually. He was like
okay.
also in the new band.
So you had like yeah, oh man.
Yeah, so two of us Clevelanders moved down together, but we went on to play with the band. We took third place in the competition, which felt great.
Nice.
But it didn't really mean anything. Mm-hmm. You know, like it wasn't like we would have played like the blues cruise or like we would have, hey, congratulations. You get to open for Buddy Guy on this blues festival now. And I'm like, yeah, we were doing that already. Nothing else was big.
Yeah.
So
didn't feel like it would have been a catalyst for
it. So
anything.
I broke the news to him and it's what I always wanted. I mean, like Nashville was the dream since I was a boy.
Had you ever come out here before? Or was that the first time?
I'd come, twice before, once when I was 15,
I think that was the first time I came to Nashville.
Nashville was like, it was always everything. It was like the Grand Ole Opry, the Ryman, even Broadway was like on my sights. And Broadway, even 2010, was not what it is now. So like, even then it was just like people from all over the country and world were like, that's where the players go. Mm-hmm. So, when I was 15, I went on a road trip with my aunt and my cousin, and, she's a big Elvis fan. And I was a
smart
person. I'm a huge Elvis fan. Right. So the deal was we were going to go to Memphis. We were going to, stop through Nashville just to see it. Mm-hmm. We're going to go to Memphis, and then we're going to go down to New Orleans. And that's what we did. And obviously Memphis was the highlight of the trip, you know. Yeah. New Orleans was great, but I just remember riding a riverboat, and even the wind couldn't stop the humidity and the awful. I mean, it was the hottest I've ever been in my life.
Yeah, the summers are rough out here.
Yeah, well, so we stopped in Nashville, but we didn't even really see, we didn't know what we're looking for. So we ended up, I don't know how long y'all have been here, but pre-flood, there was out of the Opryland Mall, Opry Mill, sorry. Still, it's, you know what I mean? Yeah. There was this thing called the Gibson Showcase, and they were building like dobros, and a couple instruments were being built there, but it was in the mall.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was like a whole thing, and there was a big glass wall. You could see what was happening. And
yeah,
that was like, as a 15-year-old who wanted something to do with Nashville, we went there, and I just played guitars for 4 or 5 hours. And like, you know, they could see, all the guys could see it. And I was good enough that they weren't like, get this kid out of here.
Yeah.
But like a little jam formed, and all these older guys are like patting me on the back. And nice. That kind of like, you know, that kind of success makes you go,
it gets under your skin.
I should do this. Yeah. And now, of course, that was like the talk of the trip. You know, I was like, you remember when that time in Nashville, you know. So, and then when I was 19, I came back with a band. We were on tour, and the singer's sister lived in Franklin, and she had like a Christian rock band that they were like doing their thing. So that was my first sight of Franklin, Tennessee, which at the time we were staying at their house in a mansion. Like, it was crazy. And they're like, yeah, Winona lives right there, and Tim McGraw and Faith Hill. I'm like, what the?
Yeah.
Right. They're like, yeah, this is where everyone, all the stars live.
Yeah.
And we did Broadway. Like, we went down to Tootsie's at like 9 a.m. and they weren't even open yet. Mm. And we had an upright bass. I had a Telecaster. He had his acoustic. And then his girlfriend was our drummer. She played a snare just standing up. We were like a rockabilly thing, right? And the sound guy was like, you know, I'll get you guys up. We don't have anyone in the back room this morning. So we played. To us, it was success. To them, it was a free band, and we were awesome. So like, they were like,
nice.
They're like, yeah, you guys, yeah, go ahead. Like, no, you're looking back, I'm like, you took us, you know, you should have paid us.
Yeah.
But so we did that. And
it's all perspective.
Absolutely. Yeah. And that like, slotted it for me, because I wanted to move here when I was 18. When I graduated high school, I was trying. Mm-hmm. Like, that was my everything. It was my goal. And then I chickened out because, you know, that's what happens when you're 18 and you really start to like do the math and you're like, that's not going to work. Mm-hmm. And I'm really grateful that I didn't, because if I had, I would have failed. I would have tucked tail and I would have went home, and then I wouldn't, you know, be on you guys' podcast today.
There you go. Yeah.
This is what it's all for.
Everything leading up to
it's up all this podcast. This. Yeah.
What? So, what was your entry into music? Has that always been a part of your life?
Yeah.
Since you were a young kid, how did that begin for you?
So, my family in the '60s. My mom's side, my mom's parents, and she had their 6 kids, and the parents. He was a preacher. And they were musicians, and a family band was how they started. And they toured the country as a family.
Oh, wow. That's amazing.
And like all the kids minus, you know, like a couple of them played.
Mm-hmm.
My youngest aunt, she never played anything. She played the tambourine real well. My oldest aunt, she was, you know, a little more nerdy. So she just kind of like stayed out. But like, my mom was a singer and a pianist. And my my aunt, the one that we came to Nashville with, she was a bass player. My oldest uncle, he could play steel, bass. It's kind of like all the family bands. You start as a bass player as the kid because grandpa plays guitar. So we need a bass player.
Okay.
And then my aunt comes along, and so she now she's the low man on the totem pole. He gets to move up to pedal steel guitar.
I'm the oldest of four, and all of us play. And my sister's the youngest, and she was stuck with the bass.
Yeah, but what happened? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Did you play bass to begin with? Did you start at least?
I played some bass.
Okay, so that's what it is. You like move up through the ranks, basically. So
gotta graduate.
He graduated up to steel and guitar and. So it's just like my whole life, that's really all I knew. Mm-hmm. And I don't remember a time when I didn't want to play guitar. Like my whole childhood, if you look back, there's pictures of me with plastic guitar. Back then they seemed full size.
Oh yeah, I know exactly.
And I look back and I see a picture and it's like that big. I'm like, so
I had like a purple one.
Yeah, man, I had a million. I actually have a good story about one of them, but I would like, we'd be at church and I'd be like three, mm-hmm. and I'd stand right next to my grandpa, who was like my hero, and I'd say, "Hey, Papa, tune my guitar." Mm-hmm. Can't tune those things. And he'd go, "Okay, buddy." And he'd, you know, get it, and then he'd give it to me. And I go, I lost my pick. And he'd fish out a pick, and he every single, you know, three times a week. I can't imagine the cost of picks for that man.
Oh, man.
So when I was six, I got my first real guitar, and by seven, the family band went back on the road.
Oh, wow.
So it was me, my mom, my aunt, my grandpa, my grandma, and we were on the road doing that. And then a few years later, my brother came along playing drums, and we literally just were now a touring band again. And it was... I mean, there were times when we'd be out of school. The loophole in the country is if you say it's my religion, they can't tell you not to.
Oh, right? Yeah, yeah.
So if you want to pull your children out of school for prolonged periods of time, you're not allowed to, unless, you know. So my mom would be like, "Well, this is for, you know, for religion." And they're like, "Oh, okay." Fine. So they give her lesson plans. So I can't say I was homeschooled, but I was like, on the brink of it, right? I mean, because there would be 2 months, 3 months at a time that we'd be gone. And that's
when you were doing this, what kind of shows were you playing?
So like Southern gospel shows. So like there would be tent revivals in the summers.
Oh, okay.
There would be big churches, or sometimes we would do like multiple nights at a church. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you'd show up somewhere and they would have rented like a gymnasium or like what's the, like the social center, you know, like there's a place in town where they're like, "Yeah, we rented this out." And, you know, you'd walk in and sometimes it would be this big and sometimes it would be the size of an auditorium. It'd just be gigantic. So it was like everything. We played flatbeds of pickup trucks. We played semi beds. We played pavilions. Wow. One time we put two picnic tables together with some wood on top for a drum riser, like whatever you could do.
Yeah.
But it's weird because in music now you measure like the success of like the size of venues you're playing or like the professionalism of your gear. Mm-hmm. And I look back to that and everything we were doing was like straight out of the 60s. Cause that's what my grandparents and parents knew, you know?
That's gotta be an interesting upbringing though. I mean, like just to get that under your belt that young has got to be really fantastic.
It's the only thing you know. Mm-hmm. So it does two things. It ruins the rest of your life in far as like, this is what is possible and this is what I want to do. Mm-hmm. So then you're just like, yeah, I don't want to do that other thing anymore. I want to just play music because I've done this my whole life and that's all I know. But I've had a million jobs, you know, just since I was,
as we all have.
Well, you know, and like that's the thing, like they weave in and out, but somehow it's always like music is the one like full-time thing.
Yeah. It's always the constant somehow for everyone.
You know, like, I don't know. I was a contractor for years. My duo partner in my band, Whiskey, Cash and Roses, she always says, "How many lives have you lived?" Cause I'm like, yeah, I did that for a few years. Mm-hmm. As a contractor. Oh, I was a custodian at a school for a while. I worked at Lowe's during, the lockdown. Mm-hmm. It's like whatever I needed, you know?
Yeah, it is. It's an interesting thing choosing to do this with one's life because you do find that all these other things come and go.
Yeah,
and it's, I think in a lot of ways it's actually beautiful because you find that you are accumulating all of these seemingly disparate skills.
Yeah,
but there is always that through line of music, and you can find. I think if the people who I think I find are the most successful at this are the people who can take those skill sets that they've learned elsewhere and find a way of applying them to music.
Yeah. As a songwriter, 1,000%, I didn't want to be a songwriter or a singer. I should always preface my conversations with that. Until I was 16, I never sang a note. Okay. My mom is still such a great singer, and both of my grandparents, they had that family harmony thing that you don't get.
That's a biological thing.
Absolutely.
Yeah, yeah.
I just thought everybody's family did that. Mm-hmm. Right? I was like, yeah, clearly your mom's got to be a singer, right? And they're like, no, not even in the shower, man. So I didn't need to sing. Why would I? I mean, how am I going to get in the way of this perfection, right? So when I was 16, I had been kind of like singing in the basement quietly, I thought, and my mom had heard a little bit. Mm-hmm. I think, and then she told me later, she's like, I didn't know like what you were, you know, I just kind of thought you were kind of like,
I thought you were jerking off.
Like, I didn't want to interrupt you. Don't come in here. I'm cleaning my room. But she, we were at this, a moose lodge, mm-hmm. right? I don't know if you're familiar with like the eagles and the you know, I used to call them the animal circuit, 'cause there's like the Elks Lodge and the moose and the eagles and the Lions Club. And, so my mom had played around bands in town for years, even though she was a gospel singer, mm-hmm. you know, in her wilder days. Mm-hmm. They actually had one of the biggest bands in Northeast Ohio for years.
Really?
Yeah, it was like the big, a huge country band. Like in the 80s when Alabama was huge, everyone's wearing 3/4 sleeve shirts and, you know. But like right before I was born. But so we go out and some friends that she hadn't seen in a long time, they're like, oh my God, Kim's here. Get her up to sing. And we get up and she's like, Rob's coming with me. So I sit in and they want her to keep going. And she basically ran out of material. She's like, I haven't sung in a bar music forever.
Yeah.
She's like, I don't know anything else. And I go, I can do one. And I called Johnny B. Good. Every, you know,
there you go.
That's Marty all you, McFly that's all every right day, there. Man.
Of course.
You know what I mean? That's a life-saving moment right there. So I call Johnny B. Good. And of course the guys know it. And I remember starting to sing, and I look over and my mom is just like this. Like, she just never thought that would ever be me. Yeah. So, you know, over the years, I tried not to be a singer. I was like, I don't want to do this. I want to play guitar. I just want to be known mm-hmm. as a guitar player. And enough singers back out of your, you know, your gig mm-hmm. Last minute and leave you hanging. You're just like,
someone's got to do it.
I got to. Yeah. It's like somebody's got to play bass. You
know? Totally. Yeah.
When did the songwriting component come in?
So when I was about 16,
I feel like that's the time it happens for a lot of us.
Right. Yeah. Well, because it was an experiment. Somebody gave me a Tascam 4-track recorder.
Okay.
And I didn't know how to use it. I just know that if I record myself playing or singing, I can, you know, record along with that. So I was using it more like a loop pedal.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
That's how I learned how to sing harmony. Because until then, how do you learn? Like, you can sing along with the radio, but like, you can't go back quick enough. So anyway, so someone gave me that, and I started doing that. And then the natural progression from that was to try to write a song. Mm-hmm. And I still the song I wrote when I was 16, it still kind of rattles around. It's never been recorded, and I played it for years, you know, like as the one song I had. But then I wrote a song shortly after that, maybe a year later. I wrote a song, and it's actually on the newest record that I put out.
Oh, there you go.
And you know, it's kind of funny to look back at. Of course, it's been like, you know, mended and changed and like mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. but I look back and it's like about it's called I Only Breathe, and it's, you know, I only breathe because you love me. I'm like, I was 17 or 16. Like, I didn't even know what the hell I was talking about. But you know, so yeah, that was my ADHD way of getting around to, as a songwriter, all of those things that you do and skills you try to acquire, you know, people want realism. People want you to like be legit. I think.
For sure.
I want that. sometimes you can tell when someone's faking the funk.
Yeah, they can, so they can sniff it out. Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
Bees and dogs can smell fear, and the crowd can smell fear and anticipation. You know, yeah. Like if you're not careful, if like, if you want the crowd to like you too much, yeah. They're like really turned off by that.
Yeah.
So, you know,
sure.
You don't need to like shun them, but I just mean, I feel like when I've been the most desperate to get somebody to like me, they're like, uh-huh. No thanks.
Cause you're trying to.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So as a songwriter, I always feel like being real like makes the biggest difference. And I have a problem in my writing, which I write too literally. Mm-hmm. So like, you know, I always like pair up with somebody who might maybe is more whimsical or maybe, you know, can get around that.
Yeah.
But, that also works for me. It's like my mm-hmm. thing. I write literally, and sometimes that doesn't, transfer over, because like then somebody doesn't get the same meaning out of my song, whereas mm-hmm. like, you know, all great songs are like somebody gets something from this. They're like, this is, I'm sure, pretty sure this is about this, mm-hmm. and the writer's like, no, it's actually about this, but I'm glad that you got that. Mm-hmm. Right. So sometimes that backfires, where my literalness kind of screws me on that, but I've tried to apply all the things, you know. And if you sing about working a 12-hour day but you've never worked a 12-hour day, then I don't know how to write about that, but I have worked 12-hour days. I've worked 16-hour days, you know?
What, had you co-written prior to coming out here, or was that something new to the Nashville experience?
I think that was new. I'm trying to think. Maybe like a little bit. Maybe I had been like accidental co-writer. Mm-hmm. You know, like I was in a band with this girl, Christine Jackson. Shout out to her, because she was like a sister to me. She was like a great singer, guitar player. Then she became a bass player because we needed a bass player in the band. Mm-hmm. And
as she, it goes. Yeah,
absolutely. And she was great too. I remember kind of sitting in while she was like, hey, I'm working on this song. What do you think about this? And I remember kind of giving, you know, some insight, and we used that. I don't know that like we weren't calling it writing then though. Like it, you know, it's more like, yeah, you offered some whatever.
Just bouncing ideas.
Yeah, I don't know if she ever gave me credit. I don't care.
Yeah.
But, you know, when I moved here and my very first co-write, I was like, whoa. Oh, okay. Like two minds, right? Mm-hmm. I've only done one three-way write. But, you know, you look at some songs and there's like six or seven writers on it.
Yeah.
And I'm like, I'd be interested to try that, but I just feel like it's too many cooks at that point.
Yeah, I get what you mean.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm always fascinated by that, and it's something I feel like I ask a lot of people, only because it's something I've never been able to do. I can't, it's very hard for me to write with other people. And so when people crack that code and get really good at it, I think it's really interesting.
So there's two sides, or there's two or three ways of that. There's someone like you who can't crack that code to like, you're like, I just can't open that up. There's also someone like me who I really only can write with the people that really work with me. Mm-hmm. Like some people I don't meld with well, but then there's guys they can literally write with anybody. It's like their job. So every day they clock mm-hmm. in and they write, and they're like, I got to co-write with this person I never met before. And I'm like, how'd it go? Good.
Yeah.
I'm like, so they're expecting something different, or their skill set is better. Mm-hmm. And my skill set is just not that.
Yeah,
totally.
Yeah. It's a different, it's interesting. I think a lot of it also depends on what it is you're looking to extract from music.
Yeah.
You know, and a lot of those people, I think a lot of the people that approach it in that manner, that what they do is they write songs with other people.
Right.
Like that is their...
It's their 9 to 5.
That's their 9 to 5. That's what they clock in every day.
Those are the people that are getting pub deals.
Exactly.
And, you know,
exactly.
Yeah.
And it's one of those things where I've, you know, songwriting is my favorite thing in the world, but I've sort of recognized at a certain point in life that that's not the function I want that to have in my life.
Absolutely.
You know? And so I think a lot of it too is just people finding what works for, you know, you and your sort of rhythm and relationship with it.
Absolutely. Yeah. The one thing that the reason that I can't write with just anybody. Now I will attempt to write with just anybody.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter. Because, like, you know, you don't know what kind of chemistry there's going to be.
Exactly.
We might get through a song, and then we both go, probably not again, or just whatever. And it's not even against them. It's just, you know, that doesn't work.
No, it's we've talked about this before on the show. It's very similar to, I think that whatever that is, whether you're talking about the dynamic between two songwriters or the dynamic between a bass player and a drummer or a guitar player and a drummer, it is akin to
there's a romantic thing. Absolutely.
Like there's either that spark or there's not. And also, it's a hard thing to quantify.
What I was going to say to lead up to that was even further, you can't be afraid to look really stupid in front of the person you're co-writing with because you will.
Exactly.
Well, you hope that they don't think that.
Yeah.
But like, if you sit back and you leave your body and you watch over this, you're going to go, that felt cringe to say that thing out loud.
Yeah.
But what if, you know, what I'm trying to say, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, there's the people that I really love writing with that I don't have that with anymore.
Mm-hmm.
I throw something out and they don't make me feel bad. You know, they just go, Or they like take it, internalize it, and then spit out like a better.
Yeah.
Like, what if that instead? I'm like, oh, yeah.
And you also kind of find your lane with that sort of delivery, too. I mean, I think of it in my head. It's almost like pitching in baseball, right? And I've kind of, for me, it's like I'm a knuckleball pitcher. I know what I am.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right,
it's like
right.
I'm Tim Wakefield. Like, I know what I do.
Right.
And so it's like some people, you know, some people can kind of feed off that and understand, okay, I get what you're doing.
Mm-hmm.
And other people, it's just that whatever, again, whatever that dynamic is, it's just, it's not there. It is really interesting finding that give and take with people in music. I think is fascinating.
And writing for a purpose too, like that changes the whole deal. Like if you're writing under pressure because you have to finish a record or whatever, that all changes things too, you know, because
for sure.
Mm-hmm. I like to write just willy nilly. I mean, you know, I smoke plenty of pot, you know, so like I'm a hippie when it comes to it, but like, I try not to have like super like, spiritual views, but like the idea that I have, and this might be too like hippy dippy, but songs float around in like the ether.
Yeah.
Like, and until you are like open yourself up enough to grab it or funnel it out, right? It's Paul McCartney is still putting out great songs. Mm-hmm. How many thousands of songs has he written? And I mean, a bunch of them that we can recite like that, you know?
I do think a lot of it with songwriting, and this does run the risk of sounding hippy-dippy, but I totally agree. I think that a lot of what you're dealing with when you're dealing with art in general is, yes, there are skill sets that you can build up to 100%. Be competent in what you're doing, but I really do feel like you are trying to grab radio signals out
of
the air.
100%.
That's what you're trying
to
do.
That's what I'm saying.
Definitely. And some people who I think are the artists, whatever medium they're working in, that I think are, that I am the most in awe of, are the people who just can bring in the most bandwidth. The people who can just,
they literally can open themselves and like, and that, you know, again, skill sets, without Paul McCartney's, abilities and, you know, talents, the thing that comes out wouldn't be what it is, obviously.
Mm-hmm.
But I've heard multiple stories from people saying, I started writing this song with this melody, with this content, and then it just kind of sat for a bunch of years, right? Mm-hmm. And I just kind of, whatever. And then I heard somebody play a song with this melody, with this content, and I'm like, I feel like if that kind of pushes my, you know, my theory to like, well, you had it and you didn't use it and it just went back up and someone else
found it.
Absolutely.
Well, there is like, if you want to get really deep into this
Please.
Thing, there is like the, I forget exactly what the theory is called, but they have discovered that a lot of like inventions over history were invented at the same time people, like, you know, in completely different parts of the world
right.
who had no access to each other's ideas at the time. So I think there is something to that sort of like,
it's a necessity.
Collective
consciousness. Yeah.
Like, yeah.
Yeah. And
collective consciousness. That's the thing.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah.
And it is funny because I do feel like whenever people talk about that, it does everyone, or I shouldn't say everyone, the vast majority of people that I have this conversation with, whether it's at this table or otherwise, a lot of us will preface that with, I know this sounds hippy-dippy and crazy, but at the same time, and I say that though, but at the same time, I think it's something anyone who functions in this world, at least to a certain degree or another. Kind of like we're all kind of on board with it. Yep. I'm sure there are some people who don't view it that way, but I do find the vast majority of people who have dedicated their lives to working in some creative world,
they
kind of all understand how that's working.
Right.
Well, yeah. I find too, like the best ideas I find, like whenever I write something, the best ideas I ever come up with almost feel like they just come to me.
Yes, absolutely.
Rather than like me trying to find something, right? And like I have written things like that.
So you've done the other way and you've like sought
it. It never comes out as like inspired, and all the best stuff I've ever written, it always feels like it kind of just found me, which again, to like someone who's not a creative person, that probably sounds like some hippie shit. Well, but like
I think
I know you guys know what I'm talking
about.
Well,
so I think like I think the delineation between the two is there's like the artist side, and like if you are open to things and you, whatever medium you're creating, movies are, you know, painting, whatever, any kind of art, and you're open to that. But then there are the people like we talked about who it's not to, even to take away from them, but they can clock in and they can write because there's like a checklist that they can go by, and they're good at that.
It's a different sort of thing.
And I don't think that that's bad. You know, I think what that ends up doing, man, you know, here we go. I'm just going to piss off everybody in the industry real quick. I think what ends up happening is a lot of stuff sounds the same on the radio.
It just sort of dilutes everything.
Yeah. And that's because those writers are doing that kind of thing, and they're not doing it for that reason. They're doing it to pump out material and get stuff cut. But then you pair that with people, you know, say in the record industry who are just like, okay, that works, so do it again and repeat it 30 times. How many John Mayers can we put out? You know, because John Mayer was great, but now we need three more because we need something to fall back on for this market. And writers do that, you know. Writers will pop out a bunch of things. And country has a lot of that. It's starting to come back around now with, you know, the Zach Tops and the Tyler
and
Childers.
There's some great stuff that's starting to kind of float to the top.
And there's always been, you know, it's just whatever's on the radio is the problem.
And the way I think about it too, and I apologize.
Clear Channel is evil. Yeah. Sorry.
And I apologize if I've said something similar to this before, but I always find that, like, for myself as a writer, and this, your relationships to these processes change over time as you know, as you move through life. But what I've always found was there were periods in my life where I would sit down every day and clock in. And to me, that process was always to keep the pipes clean, right? That was always to sit down, to go through the mechanics of being able to write.
Yeah.
And then when you know, when you're out at lunch or you're, you know, sitting in the yard or, you know, whatever, there's that moment of, oh my God, here's that idea. But you've gone through the process. And and because of that, the pipes are clean. You understand
also,
the mechanics.
Also, there's a skill set. Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
And I feel like what happens oftentimes, which is what you're getting at very clearly here in my head, is there are those people that live in that first world where they're just getting, they're incredibly competent at the mechanics of the thing. And again, in my mind, they're incredibly competent at keeping the pipes clean.
Absolutely.
But it's just kind of vacant because you haven't taken the time to find that thing worth exploring through those skills.
Yeah.
And again, like, I don't think that's a good or bad thing. I think that's kind of what happens with most, even beyond creative things in life. Anything that can be, I don't even want to say gamified, but sort of gamified, where the skill can be honed in that way, there are going to be people who get very competent at honing that skill, but then there's just nothing of substance there really to...
Yeah,
you know,
I think
to pull through.
The same goes for like musicianship too.
For sure.
So anything
like,
you know... So, you know, I've kind of, growing up in the church, you know, like where I've deconstructed and like, you know, where I'm the agnostic beliefs that I have now, I definitely believe there's something greater than us. I don't know what it is. I don't care to know. I don't need to know. But for years, the thing that would always be said as like a young guitar player, some woman would come up and go, oh my God, you're so talented. and this, you know, this God-given talent that you have. And later on, those comments would get more like directed as like, you didn't do this work. Someone else did this work. And I'm like, listen, I think 100% there is something that is flowing through me that I don't know. It's like in the blood, my whole family's musicians, but I practiced guitar for 8 hours a day. My mom would scream at me because she'd say, it's time for bed, get in bed. And I'd say, I'm in bed. And she'd come in and I'd be laying in bed with a guitar on. And I'd put the chord poster on the ceiling so that I could like lay in bed.
Oh, wow,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, so... You know, I'd shine my flashlight up there and I'd be like, F major seven. Yeah. And I'd figure it out, you know? And I remember the first time I could play through like some song with the lights off because I didn't need to see the guitar. And I was just like, oh, this is it. I've done it. So people tend to, you know, think about that. And it's like, there obviously has to be that honing of the skill, keeping the pipes clean. Or like, if you want to say something, say English isn't your first language. Spanish isn't your first language. And my girlfriend right now is actually taking Spanish classes. Mm-hmm. It's like a thing she does every night. She has to like, you know, do like 20 minutes of the Spanish lesson. Yeah. And she's like, I love this. This is great. Like it opens a part of my brain. She knows what she wants to say, but without the skill that you've honed, you can't say it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Right.
Totally.
If you want to draw and you're like, I can see this beautiful flower. And then your hand is like, I don't even know how to hold a pencil. So obviously the skill needs to be honed. Mm-hmm. But furthermore, it definitely is something in the ether that is floating around through you to come through you. And I think that in itself is a skill too. Because if you can't figure out how to open yourself up to that, mm-hmm. right?
And that's, I think that's almost, not to say that the skills to be competent
at, no, of course,
at any of those other things aren't important or difficult to acquire, because obviously they are. I do find that whatever that skill is, to be able to be receptive to those things, that's the hardest thing for people to learn. And that's the thing that I'm most in awe of when I see people who are competent at that.
Yes. Do you think that is a skill that you either have it or you don't, or you think that there are ways that you can kind of improve that tap into it?
Both, because... I know there's a few musicians who I can think of personally that I know and I love and I think are very good musicians that don't have that creative thing. And I don't think they were born with like a natural raw talent, or let's call it the ability to tap into that.
Yeah.
Right? Mm-hmm. And they have risen through the ranks and they're working musicians and they're competent. But when it really boils down to it, on the draw, they're not. You know, that's not their fault. They've tried really hard. And I think some people can work on that and open that up. Then there are some people that just do it. Like, I don't know how this happens. I don't know.
Yeah.
I just opened my mouth and lyrics came out, you know, and then I'm really jealous and jaded. I'm like, fine, you know, so, yeah, I mean, I think it's both. I think some people are more receptive to it, and I think some people have forced. I feel as though I have forced the gap. I've forced the opening because, like, when I was younger, I remember just being like, how do you do this? Here's a songwriting book. These are the things you're supposed to do, and I couldn't figure it out. I think for me, when I stopped caring about looking stupid, I know that's silly,
that's
but, like,
a big one for
sure. Yeah, because, man... You've just got to say things.
Yeah, and you just need to try. I mean, there's a certain level of just trying things.
Even when you're alone, though. Like, have you ever done something when you're alone and you're instantly red and embarrassed? And no one is there. You know? You're just like, oh, good. I
live
nobody...
in that world every day.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So I wrote a song with someone the other day, and he basically recommended, hey, man, in Logic, just pull up a drum beat. Let's play a drum beat and then let's make it up as we go. And I was like, oh, I've never written that way.
Yeah, that's interesting.
Yeah. So we did it, and he basically, you know, he takes a guitar and we plug it in and we start recording, and I throw a mic up and he's just going, and just like keeps doing that. Mm-hmm. And I remember in the back of my head thinking, this is perfect. I love this. And 10 years ago, I would have been red with embarrassment for him, mm-hmm. because of him, to be in the room with him. And he wasn't doing anything wrong. He was doing everything right.
Yeah.
And now I'm like, I don't care about that anymore.
Yeah.
There's no embarrassment here. We listen and we do not judge, you know?
Totally.
And
yeah, it's hard to get past that.
Absolutely.
Yeah, and there's not there's like with, I think, a lot of creative things, there's not a right or wrong process. And it's a lot of times I also find that shaking it up is hugely important too, because one thing that I do find is, like anything in life, people can get complacent. And if you have a process that works for you, oftentimes you can fall back on that. And I think, just as an observation, so many of my favorite creative people, whatever medium they're working in, recognize that, and their life is a series of decisions to make that harder for themselves.
Yeah. You know? Yeah.
And I think that actually yields really beautiful results, because if you can work from, if you can constantly work from that state of, insecurity maybe, or not knowing, I think it can yield really, really beautiful results. But it's something you have to be very active of putting yourself in that situation, because we are creatures of habit, and we do want to revert to what's worked in the past.
Yeah, what works. Yeah, you want to succeed.
Yeah,
that's all there is to it. Yeah. As a songwriter, since I was a kid, and I didn't even know that that's what I wanted to do. Really, I wrote those songs when I was younger because I wanted to try something, and I was in bands, and, you know, we were touring, and I remember the first time I went to Europe when I was like 20, and we were playing our own songs, and it was at a festival, it was at a world festival, so there's a lot of, the crowd was charged, it was mm-hmm. like, you know, it's a loaded crowd,
yeah,
because they want to be there,
yeah.
Right, yeah, they want to see different things. Mm-hmm. And they loved us. I mean, we're playing our own music. I think we did like 3 covers in that set, and they cheered, and then people would come and see us the next night. And then, they changed the schedule because we were doing so well and we were cooking so much. They wanted to put us on the big main stage. So they were like, hey, we're going to fit you in on this. And, you know, that feels great.
Yeah.
And a bunch of those people now came out, and we're playing to, at that point, the biggest stage I'd ever played. And it was probably 30,000 people.
Nice.
And in this little town in France. And I remember the way the mountains came down. It came to this valley. The stage was set back against a mountain, and it was as far as I could see, people just like a straight shot.
Wow.
And just going crazy. And I remember thinking, well, you know, I'd like, you know, some of my songs to be played like this.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, and then I moved to Nashville, and it wasn't about that anymore. It wasn't about, I want 30,000 people to hear my song. It was like, I have to get this out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And since I'm now, I guess since I'm a singer, you know, I have to put this out, and I have to get this out of me somehow, because it feels like I'm pent up with something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And a good breakup really helps you to need to get something out like that.
Mm-hmm.
And that's what happened. My first record is straight up about a breakup. And my second one, 10 years later almost, is about that same breakup. It's just more refined feelings. It's instead of, you know, maybe calling her out directly,
mm-hmm.
you know.
So tell me about this most recent record, which came out a couple years ago now, something
like
that. Yeah,
it was supposed to come out in April of 20.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, that thing happened,
yeah.
that little tiny thing. I think it was just consolidated down to just Nashville, right?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
It feels like it too.
Because people got sick or something?
Yeah, someone had a little sniffle or something. No, man, I had it bad. I had COVID bad in March. It was bad. But so the record was being finished up in like December of 19. And
mm-hmm.
I was ready, you know. And then when the pandemic happened, I still had the money to put the record out.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't have been able to pay rent for very much longer. You know, I ended up getting a job at Lowe's during that whole thing just to like get by, which is fine. Lowe's, the home improvement store.
Yeah.
Not Lowe's Vanderbilt Hotel, spelled different, but all the same letters.
Quality establishment.
All the same letters, just in a different order.
That's every time I see that sign, I'm like, they just need to jumble,
just jumble it up a little bit. So I pushed it back, and then we started working again in like August, and then they shut us down again. And about September, I started working. And I worked 365 days almost to the dot without taking a day off.
Damn.
Because I was so scared. I mean, the first time in my life that music had been completely eradicated.
Wow.
Live streams were whatever, but like,
yeah,
you're not really like...
It was such a weird period.
But then it was
that.
Also so overcrowded. I mean, every musician that we know is like, I'm doing live streams. Even people musicians I know who were weekend warriors, and you know, there's nothing wrong with that, but like they have a job. They're just like, well, I'm not getting to play gigs, so I'm doing a lot, and it's not a good live stream. And I'm doing my best to like put together a live stream with like, you know, I learned how to use OBS for this reason. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, you know, I don't want to learn technology, but I did. it just wasn't the same. So I was freaked out. So I worked for an entire year without, I was like, I don't care about this record that's just sitting in a hard drive. None of that. I'm working. What if we never work again? So I did that. And then finally someone was like, you need to take a vacation. You're high strung right now. You know, my voice was just roached because oh my God. So I went to Gatlinburg by myself, rented a full size cabin by myself for a week.
That's the move, right?
Yo, dude. Yeah. it was the first time in my life I'd ever taken a vacation. I mean, I've been playing music my whole life and I've been all over the world. But when they're like, we have a gig in St. Thomas, you're like, cool, I'll fly in a day early or fly out a day later. That's it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's not a vacation. Mm-hmm. You just worked and now you get to sleep in the next day. That's all it is.
Yeah.
So the first time I'd ever taken a vacation, which by the way, set the precedent for every year now, I have to take some kind of vacation. And I don't have to go thousands of dollars. I just need a week off at least. So did that, went up to the mountains, and I fully recharged. I took 2 bottles of whiskey. I bought groceries on my way in. I cooked in every day, sat on the back porch, just kind of looked out. I mean, I was like, man, this is crazy. I took a guitar with me because I was like, maybe.
Yeah, come on.
The first 4 days, I remember looking at the guitar. I opened the case up and I set it on the couch and it was just sat there. And every day I'd walk by and be like, nope, not today. I don't need that. Sometimes I'd look at it and I'd be like, I can't. So the last day, actually, I remember sitting out on the porch and thinking, let's strum a couple chords. And I wrote 2 songs just like that. And I was like, oh yeah, that's right. I have a record that I got to put out. So I came home and I prepped it all and I put it out. And that record is just a straight blues record. I played blues for years. That was like my living before I moved to Nashville. It's like, that's how I made my money, was on blues. I don't know what took me that long to put it out. All my friends are like, dude, you should have done this years ago. And I'm like, I know. It's like everything else. I'm glad I didn't because, you know, just like I'm glad I didn't move here when I was 18. I could have failed and it would have been bad songs or, you know, the wrong, it happens so often. People use the wrong engineer or the wrong studio and it doesn't sound like you or, you know,
Everything kind of happens the way it's supposed to.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And so when it finally came out, I remember, being super pleased and being like, this is, you know, and then also was instantly displeased because I forgot that, what's that thing? Nobody buys physical copies anymore. I mean, it's coming back a little bit, but CDs, especially not. Like,
yeah.
The last person I talked to said, yeah, we'll just get cassette tapes. And I'm like,
I feel like cassette tapes, maybe not as much as vinyl, but have seen a little bit of
a resurgence. They are 1,000%, and they're super cheap to put out.
They are. We did years ago, probably 7 years ago, 8 years ago now, 8 years ago, I did my first record, and we did a whole like crowdfunding for it, made LPs and stuff, and it did really well. And so one of the things that we wanted to do is, like, we wanted to give back because we made more money than we thought we were going to, and we decided to do cassettes. Surprisingly cheap to do cassettes.
They are cheap, yeah, and they sound really good.
And they actually sound fantastic. Yeah. I'm like, I'd prefer cassette over CD.
I think it's like everything else. So, like, vinyl is absolutely coming back.
Yeah. And but vinyl for good reason, I feel like.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. It's like everything else. So, like, the reason that I'm not moving CDs like I want to move is everyone tells me, they're like, I don't even have a CD player anymore. If you have a car that's later than 2018, they're just like, we quit putting them in here.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, what about at home? I saw a dude the other day that said, he posted, does anybody have a computer with a disk drive? And I was like, oh, dude, what? Because, you know.
Yeah, I'm in that boat now, too. I mean.
None of that happens. Yeah, they don't have them anymore.
Yeah.
So, you know. By the way, you can go on Amazon for like $15 and buy a disk drive.
There you go.
Not Amazon. Website you choose, not Amazon. Yeah. But like you can buy them for like $15 now.
You work in a group, Whiskey Cash and Roses, right?
Whiskey Cash and Roses, yeah.
How did all that transpire? Man, I'm kind of curious about that.
Okay, so I moved to town, I'm touring, and I'm touring hard with this country artist. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, I'm so grateful for the opportunity that I had doing that. But I was like starting to get a little bit like burned out a little bit. I'd been on the road full time since I was a kid. And now I moved to Nashville and I'm on the road fuller time somehow, mm-hmm. you know, and mm-hmm. country acts don't take time off. You have Mondays and Tuesdays off basically. So I'm like starting to play on Broadway a little bit because like, it's fun. It's like, it's different. Now I get to like think on my feet instead of playing the same 45 minute set every single night. Mm-hmm. And I meet this woman, Holland, and a buddy of mine is playing guitar for her. And he's like, hey man, I can't do this gig. Can you fill in? It's kind of last minute. Mm-hmm. And I am scared shitless because even though now you can't scare me when it comes to like, whatever, I don't know this, I'll play it. I didn't know standards. I didn't know how Broadway worked. Mm-hmm. And even the standards that I played in bars, because I've been playing in bars since I was 14. That's all different from Cleveland, Ohio to Nashville, right? Even being a country music fan, there were hundreds of country songs. I'm like, I don't know what that is. So anyway, I take this gig and we're playing... it's a bar called Bootleggers, and it's actually still there somehow. She's great. She's singing so great. She's funny, and the stage is super sticky. Relevant. You remember like Fireball was like the craze, you know, 2011 or 12. Everyone was drinking, so every stage downtown was sticky. It's so gross. Anyway, I go to step forward to sing something with her. And when I step back down, it feels weird. And I look back and the heel cap of my cowboy boot is stuck on the stage. It had pulled off. She looked at me and told the greatest dad joke, which instantly solidified our friendship. She said, hey, man, you got no soul. And I was like, you're going to be my best friend. And, you know, that was over... Golly, what is that? 12, 13 years ago? That's 2012?
Yeah, 13 like that. Years. Yeah.
So we played together. We played a bunch of gigs, and it kind of, we both decided after about a month or two of like gigging together, she was still waitressing at the Cheesecake Factory, and I was tired of the road, and we both kind of had whined to each other. And she said, how about I make you a deal? I was telling her I might quit the road. And she goes, if you're going to quit that, I'll quit the Cheesecake Factory. And then we don't have a choice but to work. Like if we don't work, we starve. Mm-hmm. And I was like, okay. And literally within the next 3 weeks, we had three you know, weekly gigs. And then that morphed into, the industry is very sexist. We probably don't deal with it, but women do all the time when it comes to that. Mm-hmm. So what would happen is they would be all, well, you know, we don't know if we want a female, even though she is incredible and she sings so many, like, you know, dude songs and kills it, and is super entertaining. So we basically figured out a way to work the system. And if we're co-fronts and mm-hmm. we're the face of this thing, now this is the best of both worlds. Yeah. They're like, oh, well, we've got a guy.
Yeah.
We've got a, we can cover all the bases. I'm like, we were doing that anyway.
Yeah.
We just weren't called a band name.
Rebranding.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. It's literally a rebranding.
Smart branding right there.
Yeah. And, you know, it's funny because you think about, you have so many band names through the years and things work and don't mm-hmm, work.
Yeah.
And Whiskey, Cash, and Roses came because we always say it's the three best things. It's whiskey because who doesn't want a glass of whiskey? Cash because, well, we got to pay rent. And roses because we just want to feel like pretty people, you know?
I love it. Yeah. Love it.
What, so what's your relationship with Broadway now? Like, is that something that, is that still a big part of your,
it still
your
is.
Week? Or how does that work?
It's still like daily. Mm-hmm. I probably, let's see, I have steady Tuesdays, steady Fridays and Saturdays, and then a lot of Wednesdays, like almost steady. Mm-hmm. So it's pretty much at least 4 days a week I'm downtown.
Okay.
The difference is the gigs that I've worked myself into with Whiskey, Cash, and Roses, we've grown and we've, for lack of a better term, someone told Holland one time, you're like an elder of Broadway. And she's like, excuse you? Don't ever call me, you know. I'm 40 now. I'll be 40 this year. And now I don't play those gigs that pay $20 a man. And, mm-hmm. you know, we're playing to angry crowds. Now we're playing like places like Category 10, which they used to be the Wild Horse, and we were a house band there for years mm-hmm. before that. So we're like just, we're elders, we're grandfathered in, you know?
Yeah.
And then Ole Red on Saturdays. And like those are, even though those are corporate bars, they still have enough of a honky tonk vibe and enough of like, we still do our shtick, but the money's better. The people are better. They're primed.
Yeah.
They're pre-primed, you know? And since they're corporate, that leads to a ton of corporate work.
Yeah, that's right. Really nice.
Private parties, you know, and here's the thing, man. Musicians and comedians always have to, we always bitch about private events because it's hard. Mm-hmm. Sometimes you play to a group of 75 businessmen who don't give a shit that there's a band. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, they expect it to be like a iPod or something. Or the opposite side, you play to 75 businessmen who are ready to cut loose. And it can be either one of them. We could play a Tuesday private and a Wednesday private, and they're both polar opposites, you know? So we've learned how to finagle that. And so Broadway is such a big part of my life because there's private events happening for really big money right there in the bar that I always play anyway.
Yeah.
And that's awesome. That is awesome.
Yeah.
That's really nice.
Yeah. And it really helps.
Yeah. That's one thing, Brian, and I've been talking about. Actually, we were just talking about before you got here today. We've been talking about for a while doing like some kind of corporate gig stuff with the jazz group.
Cause
I mean, that's something we haven't done in a while, but it's something that I think is kind of gnawing at both of us to be like, yeah, it'd be probably a good thing to
absolutely
to get back.
Generally get paid a little more than the local bar.
You get treated better. The one thing I'll say that I'm very grateful about with like the Whiskey, Cash, and Roses thing is I've been part of a wedding band or a corporate band before. Mm-hmm. And this is, we don't have to be like that. You know, like when you see like, there are great ones and this is not a slight, but like if you see like the Nashville Yacht Club band, mm-hmm. they're incredible, mm-hmm. but like they are very much aimed at corporate work.
Yeah.
That's what their thing is. We still do like, you know, this is what we do in a bar.
Yeah.
You know, you might have to cut that back, dial it back a little bit. But like, if it's like, you know, picking some guy out of the crowd and like kind of giving him a hard time and like making them feel like, you know, that's a thing. One time we got hired by Microsoft to play like their party, but they wanted Holland and I to come in the morning and play a couple songs for their like morning meeting.
Oh, wow.
And we're like, and the guy goes, what we want you to do is we want you to play a song, and then we want you to teach us like a couple country sayings, because Holland is from North Carolina, so she says things, you know, those one-liners, and you're just like, what are you, 75? That's incredible. So that was the deal, you know? Yeah. And like, you learn how to roll with that. Again, 10 years ago, I would have been like, cringe, but now I'm like,
Cool, got it.
All cool, right. Good money, easy work, and that's what we do. We do things like that in the bar anyway.
Yeah,
yeah.
So exactly.
Yeah.
What for you? What's kind of next on the horizon creatively? Like, where is your mind at currently?
Death. No, I'm just joking. no, man, I don't know. That changes. You know, I never thought I was going to be a homeowner. Because I was like, yeah, renting is easy. Like, you, someone else fixes it. Now I'm a homeowner. So that, the goal was like this. And then now the goal is like this. I think next, the biggest thing is to focus harder on recording, like myself, but also like for other people. You know, like, because I've been flying tracks for years and I've been on countless records since I've moved here. But like now it's like, well, how can I turn this into playing 3 days a week on Broadway and working in my studio 3 days a week? You know, like that kind of thing. Because right now that money doesn't roll in enough to warrant, you know, buying a new UA interface that is more channels that I want to buy. You know, until then, it's like, okay, well, this is good enough. And the same thing goes for myself. I said earlier that I've made the decision, or I regretted the decision of printing CDs, and I won't ever do that again. Like now it's digital media. I think, I can't say never. If I record a collection of songs and I really love them, I might commit them to some kind of physical media. But it's so easy with DistroKid or whatever to like just put out songs.
Yeah.
So now, why am I not? Right. And so I've started, doing it again. I've started like just banking stuff, you know? And, so I'm going to just drop songs monthly or whatever, you know, whatever it's going to be. And then
I think that's the way to do it.
It doesn't cost you, it costs you the subscription to DistroKid essentially.
Yeah.
It doesn't cost you anything else other than that.
As someone who, has had a relationship with music for a long time throughout the course of your entire life. And I mean, we all know, as much as we all love music, that ebbs and flows like a lot of things. And there's those times where you think, why the fuck did I decide to do this?
Oh, yeah.
But as someone who it appears to me just genuinely loves music, what is your, what's your current relationship with it? Why, what is it that you really get out of it at this point in your life? Besides just being, I mean, what you do to support yourself, because that's once that's the case for anyone, you're kind of not handcuffed to it, but there's that dynamic at play.
Sure.
But besides that, what is it that you actually feel like you get out of music at this point in your life?
I think it's the release of that pent up creativity, or sometimes emotions that you you can't get out otherwise. Like, you don't, maybe you don't know how, and like I don't know how, and I don't, I've never gone to therapy. I want to, but the one thing that music has always done is like kind of been a little bit of a therapy.
For sure.
It's therapy. 100%. So I don't want to bring anything down. My cousin just passed away a week ago, and she was like a sister to me. When I got the news, I remember kind of not having like any feeling, right? It was just like, is something wrong? Am I broken?
Yeah.
6 hours later, I'm in my studio working on a track for someone else, and something just broke. And, you know, of course I break down, but out of that, I wrote a song just like that, right? It was that was the therapy of like getting those emotions out by a song, you know? And I don't know that I could have done that otherwise, you know? Mm-hmm. And I think that's the thing that music does for me, is it gets those emotions out big time. And sometimes it's on stage, you know, whether it's happy or sad or giddy or whatever. I think that's the biggest gain for me, is working through all of it, totally. ups and downs, mm-hmm. you know?
Yeah. Music is very unique in that way. I think, just art in general, I think has the capacity to really,
I've never seen a painting that made me emotional, but I've seen people get emotional at a painting, and never once did I ever think that's not possible. It's just like somebody does this and it hits you a certain way, and it could be blobs of ink on a paper, or it could be a song, and like it hits people a certain way. Or think about the artist that was putting that thing out at the time. Like they needed to say this thing and it came out that way.
I always feel very, very lucky that I create things.
Yeah.
But just the fact that I have the ability to relate to art, I think is really, mm-hmm. that's just such a huge part to me of being a person. I mean, there's outside of my loved ones in life, there's really nothing else that I think even compares to that being a human being. It's just being able to listen to a song, watch a film, look at a painting and be truly affected by, be truly affected by that.
Yeah. Deep down.
And I think it's, I'm always, it's one of those things I'm just daily appreciative of, because a lot of people
I need to be more appreciative of it. Cause that you bring that point up, it makes me think that I don't know that I think I am appreciative, but I don't think I'm enough. Mm-hmm. I'm appreciative enough.
And I think we all have the capacity to be moved by art.
Yeah.
But I feel that most people, and this is not a moral statement, but I think most people go through life and, you know, their relationship to those things are very surface level. You know, they might be listening to music on your drive to work. It might be, you know, half watching a movie when, you know, your kids are sitting in the living room and you're making dinner. And a lot of us go through life with that relationship to those things. And I just feel constantly very lucky that I've, for better or for worse in life, enjoyed taking the plunge.
Yeah, you know, absolutely. What I mean? And it's, man, Ted Danson, obviously we're all fans of Ted Danson. He's awesome. Right. Mm-hmm. I listen to his new podcast all the time, and his wife, Mary Steenburgen, she had some kind of procedure done. And when she came out of anesthesia, she started writing songs.
Oh, really?
It was like a thing. Something happened.
Huh?
I
need to get some surgeries done. See that'll help.
I laughed about it because I was thinking, well, what can I do to ramp this up? So now she's a songwriter, and she has songs placed in movies and stuff, right? And co-writes with people.
Yeah.
Incredible. And she was 50 or something or older when that happened.
Yeah, that's wild.
But Ted Danson admits that he doesn't, music doesn't work for him. Like, he doesn't get anything out of it. It's very surface level. But obviously, he's a great actor, so he gets art from something else.
Yeah.
He's probably a person that can see a painting and be moved by it. I've yet to find the painting that will do that to me. I want to, but music does that. So I'm good with that sector of art moving me. But whenever somebody says something like that, like their music doesn't really do anything for me, I'm just like, for a second, I'm like appalled. And then I'm like, wait, no, it's fine. I can't imagine not.
Yeah, you almost like take offense to it.
Yeah.
In a sort of,
not even my music. Listen to anything.
Someone else would probably say the same thing about painting.
Absolutely. Stuff. Yeah.
Different things speak to different people in different ways.
Some kind of expression, though.
Yeah.
You got to get something from some kind of it. And there are sadly people that don't get anything from any expression. And I'm just like,
I don't know how you live
what
like
a
that.
Bleak.
Yeah.
No, totally. Truly. I mean, I think it is the. Once you recognize what that pattern is in the world, I mean, you could see it in a well-carved table. I truly think that.
Yeah.
But once you see and are appreciative of there's a word that I love. So when I was in like high school, there was a bunch of other like high school kids my age who had a band called Meraki, there was a big math rock scene in the SoCal at the time, and that's what I played in for years and did all that kind of stuff.
Math rock,
But they had this band called Meraki, which they said, which I to this day still don't know if this is true, but I love this, and so I never bothered to actually really do any true research. But that the word Meraki means to put oneself in the thing that you create. And whatever that thing may be.
Yeah.
Right? And I do think that if there's any true joy in life, again, outside of your relationship to certain people, I think I think this is just kind of true of us as people. The greatest joy that can be found in life is that recognition of Meraki, and also the act of doing it.
Yeah, right? 100%.
And I do really think that that is, if there is a secret life, it's probably something like that, but I'm a fucking idiot, so I don't know.
No, I mean, I think, here's the thing about that. There are times in my career, there's even times of the month that I'm not fully immersing myself to put myself into the thing I'm doing, right? And I can always feel when I do. Like, I can feel the difference whenever I am 1,000% in, mm-hmm. right? Or maybe I'm playing a gig and I decide to, like, be present, right? Or, you know, because maybe I'm not tired that day or, like, whatever reason.
Whatever it might be.
Man, I feel so much. I get something more from it even. Mm-hmm. Or sometimes I leave a gig and I'm like way more exhausted than I should be. And I'm just like, yeah, I really did it today, you know? Yeah. And that actually happened a couple weeks ago. I was playing a gig and I'd been on autopilot for a while about these gigs. And, I remember leaving and being like, the crowd felt it. I felt it. The band felt it. Yeah. I was like, oh. Yeah, so that's
good.
Yeah.
Good
day. I never thought of that.
Do you find that that's something that you have like some degree of control over, or do you find that's something that's just totally random? Because I know what you're talking about, and sometimes I feel like for me it's totally random, and I wish I had some sort of way to like get myself in that headspace.
Yeah, I think it's mostly random, but I also think it's sometimes if you are tired, it's hard to not to go on autopilot, because like your body is just kind of like in survival mode, right?
Yeah, yeah.
And if you're playing 5, 6, 7 gigs a week, at some point you're just like, oh God, like,
yeah.
But there is also like, there are times that if you saw me in the Lowe's parking garage before some gigs, mm-hmm. you'd be like, what is this? I'm in the garage going, you know, like just like jump in, like kind of whatever, getting my heart rate going. And I'm just about to go play to a mostly vacant bar, you know, because those little 4 to 7 gigs are like just whatever, you know, and like the bartenders are really the ones that I end up playing to. Mm-hmm. But, I want to be present, because that right there is like, if I go on autopilot on a gig like that, you know,
yeah,
any chance of winning over the crowd that might come in is not going to be there.
Yeah.
But then there are times whenever I'm ignored for 2.5 hours by a crowd full of people we'll just use that place as example. Because they don't care that I'm there, and they don't have to, it's not their job. They didn't book me. But they're doing everything they can to talk over me, because they're like, well, this is bothersome to us.
Yeah.
And there's times that I'll just go, okay. And I like autopilot, and you know, the goggles come down, and I just kind of like,
yeah,
you know, I go,
gotta like, read the room. You know?
My sight goes from them to like right here. And I'm like, this is what's happening. But I wish I could control it more, but I definitely have found that like putting yourself in that headspace before the gig, kind of like you just kind of, you know, shake around, jump up, get your heart rate going, and then say, I really want to enjoy this gig, right? Yeah. Sometimes it doesn't work. Sometimes the band, the rest of the band is in a bad mood and there's nothing you can do, mm-hmm. you know? Sometimes you try your best, but the crowd won't let you, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
I don't know. If, have you ever played a gig to a crowd full of people that didn't really care, or even like they were watching?
Plenty.
Well, yeah, no, yes, yeah, absolutely. But they're, maybe they're watching you, but they're somehow they're not giving anything back, yeah. right? Oh, maybe yeah. they don't. Maybe it's they don't clap at the end, or maybe they're not like singing along, whatever. And they're watching you, but then you feel like you're fighting a wall,
yeah. right?
But then you play a gig to like, you know, same size crowd, and they're giving it back, and you're like, I could play for 9 more hours because like there's like this energy exchange,
yeah, mm-hmm.
you know, totally. But if you're just throwing it at the wall and it doesn't bounce back when it's just yeah, it splats out. Yeah. yeah. Whereas like when the energy's right, you're throwing it, they're throwing it. And it's just like that. Yeah. Like that's the, all those times happen and you can't do anything about it. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. The only thing you can do is get better about recovering after you're done. Because how hard are we on ourselves after a gig? If you've made mistakes or when the crowd wasn't into it, you're just like, ah, why do I even do this?
Yeah.
yeah.
Totally. I'm terrible at what
we've
I
all,
do.
We've all felt that. You know?
I've watched people downtown play the shift before us, and I think, probably wrongly so, they kind of, they're not very good, right? Mm-hmm. They suck a little bit. Very vanilla or whatever it is.
Yeah.
And the crowd is just digging it.
Yeah.
And I have this thought, and I tried not to have this thought. I have this thought of maybe I'm wrong. I don't know what I'm doing. If that's what the, if that's what they're after, I'm not good, mm-hmm. you know? And then of course, you know, that's false. You know,
yeah.
I'm good at what I do, but I'm just like, for a second, I'm just like, maybe I don't know what I'm doing.
Is it me?
Yeah. 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 Hi, it's me. I'm the problem. It's me. You know? Yeah,
exactly. Dude, I got to say, this was a ball. We were, yeah. we're really looking forward to this. Like, this is a ton of fun.
Yeah, man, this is wonderful. I mean, good Lord.
It's been a process, but you know, it's so far so good.
How long is this? Like, what's the,
Not that long. We started doing this, probably 4 months ago, 5 months ago, something
okay.
like that.
Yeah.
Not that long. There was some build up, you know, leading up to it where we had to, you know, figure out how the heck we were going to do it.
Sure.
We talked about it for a while, but yeah, I think first one came out in October, end of October,
be
something like that.
Number what, like 24 or something?
I think you'll be 24 or something already.
Yeah.
That. Yeah. So that's a good number. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, man. Under 50 is always good,
you
know?
There you go. Heck yeah.
I'm in the first class, you know?
Yeah, exactly. you get that S tier, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Now, you know, as long as it's run long enough that I get to come back, you know, that's yeah,
of course.
That's yeah. the thing.
We're trying to go as long as we can.
Yeah, yeah, of course.
We're not repeating any guests, but eventually I'm
sure. That's what happens. Yeah, you end up going,
you'll be one of the first
calls.
Yeah,
let's do this back. You know, that's the thing. I'm going to start a podcast again, my third one, and, you know, I don't know how I want to hook it, but I definitely want it to be something like this where
yeah.
it's like, we talk about music because obviously that's everything to me.
Sometimes we'll go, you know, forever without talking about any music.
Well, you know, there's comedy podcasts I listen to and their rule is not to talk about comedy on their podcast.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's what you do for a living. It's
yeah.
like, but
yeah.
you know,
that's
what?
When you start doing with some people, when we get some people in here, like, hey, we're not talking about music today.
That's fine. You know, that's honestly too, though. That's when the repeat guests, you're just like, all right, yeah. we talked to you about music for an hour and a half,
exactly.
but no more music this time.
Yeah, totally.
Let's talk about Italian food or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Hey, I'll talk anything. Yeah.
yeah.
No, really, Rob, this was a ton of fun. So yeah, I'm glad you did it.
Boys, thank you so much. Dude. That was absolutely wonderful.
The songs
wonderful.
Were great, too. I'm excited to hear the songs back because they were sounding killer.
Sweet.
So.
Yeah.
Heck yeah. I love it, dude.
Yeah. Thanks, boys.
Sweet.
Appreciate it.
Hell yeah. Man, it's been a ball doing this, honestly. It's been so much fun. Like,
it is a lot of fun.
Yeah. I mean,
this is the fun part. There's a lot of
yeah.